Chapter 3. Digital Journey. The life you had? That's over. I'm sorry about what happened to you, but the most important thing is you understand the life you once had is gone. The choice you have is about the life you have next. This speech, perhaps the most moving in FX's 2020 Artificial Intelligence Series Devs, conveys an idea that many CEOs and marketing executives are hearing, or ought to be hearing, with the dawn of the second consumer revolution. Lots of them have resisted. They've tried to believe that social media is just a lot of millennial nonsense, like cancel culture, trigger warnings, safe spaces, purple bangs, and participation trophies. The purpose of this chapter is to convince them that, with respect to SRM, they are wrong. The character in Devs has to completely and instantly change the way she sees the world, or she is going to die. She has to recognize that everything she thought she knew about her life prior to this minute no longer has any relevance. The same is true for business leaders. Hanging on to the past, living with entrenched attitudes, trusting the status quo, sentimentalizing old triumphs, and giving in to nostalgia. None of these are options. Revolutions are scary. Not everyone survives. Change takes courage. If you can convince yourself there's a way out, you'll fail to summon that courage, guaranteed. But the truth is that there is no way out. You're facing a binary choice. Be brave or be finished. The CEO's Journey, Upending the Old. In the pre-internet era, marketing was a monolithic, high-dollar, undemocratic industry. Businesses had three basic options: television, radio, and print. Fortune 500 companies traditionally spent billions developing slick TV commercials and paid to air them at the most widely watched events, such as the Super Bowl, the Masters Tournament, and the Emmys. They placed expensive ads in glossy trend-setting publications, such as Vanity Fair, Vogue, and GQ. Smaller companies had to settle for radio spots on the local stations, TV spots during college football games, ads on city billboards, and tacky inserts in newspapers. The term broadcasting suggests the inherent limitations of this approach. Most of us forget, or never knew, that this word was in wide use centuries before the invention of radio waves. It described a quick, inefficient agricultural practice in which a farmer scattered seeds, often across unplowed earth, fully aware that only a small fraction of them would germinate. Like an oak tree dropping thousands of acorns, most of which will be eaten by squirrels or die in the sun-starved and infertile earth beneath the parent's canopy, the farmer hoped to offset the inefficiency of the process by volume of the output. The marketing broadcast is equally inefficient. The producer throws a generic message in the consumer's face on a one-way channel, interrupting the program everyone wants to watch, in the full knowledge that only a few members of the audience are potential buyers. During the 2020 Super Bowl, for example, Porsche spent $10.2 million for a 60-second spot advertising the Taycan, its first fully electric car. But how many viewers need a new car? And what fraction of those can afford a model with a starting price of $79,990? And how many of those were taking a bathroom break during the timeout when the ad aired so they didn't miss part of the game? Albany used one of the myriad ad-blocking strategies available to consumers. Businesses that purchase TV commercials are the advertising equivalent of the stranded islander who corks a note in a bottle and tosses it into the sea. Moreover, the advertiser has no way of tracking the ad's impact on the few people with the money to buy the car. No way of determining whether another approach would have reached more potential buyers or what parts of the message resonated or failed to resonate with the audience. Perversely, the practice continues despite the knowledge that it isn't working. As Anthony Puntoriaro notes, think about how disastrous it is for these Fortune 500 companies to invest millions upon millions of dollars on advertisements that do not yield a positive return on investment, if any at all. Gary Vaynerchuk echoes this point. Every person here grabs his or her phone any time that there is a commercial. Yet $80 billion is spent by the biggest brands in the world to make 30-second videos of a Jeep going up a hill, or some guy grabbing a beer, or some lady with a baby using some oil. $80 billion. It's completely not practical. It's broken. And it's the reason that 95% of the Fortune 500 biggest brands in the world have declined in market share over the last 2 years. At fastforward.ai, I emphasize to CEOs that their money could deliver a far more substantial return on investment if they embrace an SRM approach, if they abandon the familiar path and embark on a new journey. But far too many of them simply can't break with the status quo or override the objections of their hidebound marketing departments. So their companies end up like a promising young fighter under the misguided tutelage of an old-school trainer. They employ outdated workout and dietary regimens because they can't bring themselves to trust the latest science-based innovations. They crack a raw egg into a glass of beer and gulp it down because this is what, allegedly, worked for Sugar Ray Robinson or some champ from a bygone era. And even after they show up flat and overtrained and get mauled, they return to the gym and double down on the same strategy. It's sad. It's dumb. And at some level, they don't like to hear this. It's cowardly. Because it's a refusal to face the truth. I once watched a bird that had flown through the open door on a dark warehouse. He strutted straight for the glass transom in the roof because he could see the sun and the sky beyond it. Again and again, he crashed into the glass and fell to the ground. There was nothing I could do for him. He literally battered himself to death because he couldn't accept that the obvious path to freedom was blocked. And he couldn't convince himself to resist his instinct and launch himself into the unknown and frightening darkness, which was his only route to survival. And I'm sorry to say it, but I think of that bird whenever I talk to CEOs imprisoned by their own outmoded ideas. Joseph Chilton Pierce made a point that manages to both be obvious and profound about leadership during revolutionary times. You can't build a new foundation by digging the same hole deeper. Vertical thinking keeps excavating the same ruin. Lateral thinking looks for a new place to dig. The courage to make that lateral leap is what will distinguish those who thrive in the impatience economy from those who die asserting that what worked in the past will work in the future. The wartime CEO. Imprisoned by Benito Mussolini, the Italian philosopher Antonio Gramsci aptly described periods of revolutionary change. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new is struggling to be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. In the interregnum created by the second consumer revolution, morbid symptoms abound. Leaving aside the commercial effects of the coronavirus pandemic, we see businesses struggling, and often failing, to adapt to new market conditions and consumer demand. All the old practices and certainties are either failing or about to fail. Consider that only 2 of the top 10 retailers in 1990 are still thriving today. Or that Macy's lost 80% of its value from April 2019 to April 2020. As the chart below suggests, Gramsci's phrase, "the old is dying," is mortally relevant to our age. Ben Horowitz's distinction between peacetime and wartime CEOs highlights the kind of leadership required to abandon time-tested marketing formulas and boldly face the new reality. Like it or not, every business now needs a wartime CEO. As Horowitz says of his own experience in this role, I'll follow the first principle of the Bushido, the way of the warrior. Keep death in mind at all times. He emphasizes that the most important characteristic of such leaders is courage, particularly as it relates to resisting the status quo. In my experience as CEO, I found that the most important decisions tested my courage far more than my intelligence. The right decision is often obvious, but the pressure to make the wrong decision can be overwhelming. If we look at a chart of stock price growth from 2006 to 2016, Amazon grew 1,919%, Walmart just 2%. Sears had negative 95% growth, JCPenney was negative 83%, Kmart negative 59%, Macy's negative 49%, Nordstrom negative 21%, and Target negative 15% growth. Transformational change that upends conventional wisdom can only come from a wartime CEO. It has to be driven from the top down. Mid-level employees have far too much investment in the status quo. To some extent, small organizations have an advantage here. They are nimbler. Think of the difference between turning over a kayak and turning over an aircraft carrier. It's just a matter of physics, the laws of inertia. In a big organization, you're going to have marketing people come in with their charts and graphs, and the CEO simply has to tell them, "Look, I understand what you're recommending. But the thing is, we've been slipping 3 to 4% a year for the last 15 years, and we've had to close 60 stores in the past year, or 125 if you're Macy's. So I'm overruling you. We're going to make this change, period." A recent New Yorker cartoon perfectly captures this crucial moment of self-assertion. A resolute CEO is sitting at the head of a meeting table, looking at all his top employees, and with a stern expression that declares, "What I'm proposing is this. No." That's funny, but it takes a lot of guts to say, "We're making a change, and I may not fully understand it, and I know you disagree with me, but we're doing it anyway." It takes a wartime CEO. Horowitz is great on this point, and every business leader should commit these epigrammatic points to memory. In peacetime, leaders must maximize and broaden the current opportunity. As a result, peacetime leaders employ techniques to encourage broad-based creativity and contribution across a broad set of possible objectives. In wartime, by contrast, the company typically has a single bullet in the chamber and must, at all costs, hit the target. The company's survival in wartime depends on strict adherence and alignment to the mission. Peacetime CEOs know that the proper protocols lead to winning. Wartime CEO violates protocol in order to win. Peacetime CEO always has a contingency plan. Wartime CEO knows sometimes you gotta roll a hard six. Peacetime CEO aims to expand the market. Wartime CEO aims to win the market. Peacetime CEO strives for broad-based buy-in. Wartime CEO neither indulges in consensus building nor tolerates disagreements. Peacetime CEO trains her employees to ensure satisfaction and career development. Wartime CEO trains her employees so they don't get their asses shot off in the battle. Peacetime CEO thinks of the competition as other ships in a big ocean that may never engage. Wartime CEO thinks the competition is sneaking into her house and trying to kidnap her children. Peacetime CEO has rules like, "We're going to exit all businesses where we're not number one or number two." Wartime CEO often has no businesses that are number one or two, and therefore does not have the luxury of following that rule. The consumer's journey. If the first part of my challenge at fastforward.ai is to convince CEOs that their survival requires them to journey beyond conventional marketing practices, The second part is to teach them how necessary it is to create journeys for their customers and systematically evaluate those journeys to increase sales. On the most technical level, marketers use journey to describe the path a consumer takes before buying a product. Now, with traditional advertising, the touch points in that progression are impossible to track. There isn't any journey. You haven't created one. You're on a TV ad during a Dallas Cowboys football game. And if your sales increase in the viewing area over the next week, you assume that the ad accounted for that increase. But this is a very crude measurement. You don't have any sense of who is or isn't responding to the ad, or what parts are or aren't persuasive, or whether a different kind of approach might have produced better or worse results. The same is true with something like a digital billboard in a Google ad or a Facebook ad. You're still essentially blind to the complex chain of events that leads to a purchase. With SRM, however, all of that changes. Now, when you show people something, the image of a dress shirt, for example, you're establishing a two-way channel. You know precisely how many people clicked on it and what those people have in common. You can create multiple journeys and use simple A-B testing to determine if you get a greater response for a red shirt or a blue shirt, an indoor or outdoor setting, a handsome model or a regular-looking Joe, a famous person with blue eyes or a man on the street with brown eyes, or, to stick with our dress shirt example, the Hathaway man. His swashbuckling eye patch, which cost 5 cents at the time, created $1 million in sales and moved the company from relative obscurity to its position as the second largest U.S. shirt maker. Why? Because it told a story. An obscure, nondescript model became a man out of a Hemingway tale or a John le Carré spy novel. The company ran ads showing him playing the cello, holding a shotgun, standing at a blackboard in front of a complex set of physics equations. Consumers couldn't look at this guy without lingering a moment, wondering who he was and how he'd gotten hurt, and if the shirt might offer them the same air of mystery. You get the idea. The point is to design journeys based on data that you can track. You give consumers choices. See what they choose as they swipe or click from one box to another, and then you fine-tune the next iterations. You're setting up a Darwinian process in which the consumer exerts the selection process, and your messages adapt to the marketing environment. It's survival of the fittest. After each computerized assessment of the data, because you don't need people to do this, you're moving closer and closer to the marketing equivalent of Secretariat, and further away from some generic swayback nag giving kids $2 rides at a county fair. You can't do that with a static image in People magazine or a commercial you play over and over until people want to puncture their eardrums and gouge out their eyes. You can't build a relationship with the consumer that way, nor can you do so by simply giving traditional single-direction ads a quick digital patina. The average consumer is exposed to 1,700 banner ads each month, but fails to notice, let alone respond to, more than half of them. Moreover, just going digital in an uninformed way can be counterproductive. Suppose you send out a blatant, heavy-handed ad, and you promise the recipients a discount if they share that ad with their friends, most of whom will be annoyed for getting spam. This isn't social media. It's anti-social media. Over time, you're more likely to lose consumers than gain them. As Tim Staples notes in Breakthrough the Noise, The 9 Rules to Capture Global Attention, the single most important challenge for social retail marketers is to provide stories that consumers want to share. Being shareable means that you create content with such high value for the people viewing it that they are compelled to share it with their friends. Their mindset puts the consumer first and builds a relationship before attempting to sell, essentially the opposite of traditional advertising's approach. The share is the most coveted action. It commands the highest premium and delivers the most value. That's because a share is what turns your audience into your brand ambassador. Word-of-mouth recommendations from friends have always been the most persuasive form of advertising, but they've never been scalable. Even if your ambassador was riding a Kawasaki Ninja crotch rocket while shouting through a bullhorn, his words were never going to reach many potential buyers. But that was before social media. People who use Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, YouTube, and other platforms are constantly sharing what they like with their friends or followers. You'll need to develop separate journeys and stories tailored to the specifics of each platform. But the payoffs for doing so are impossible to overstate. Consider this. If you send a message to 50 million Facebook users and 2% like it, you've just picked up a million ambassadors. You're now part of a million stories. And when your new ambassadors share your message with their friends, the number of journeys you've set in motion compounds. And then some fraction of that group shares it with their friends, and then some fraction of that group. But even that is not the end of the good news. Because by analyzing data on the likes and shares, you can start to form various profiles of others on Facebook who might respond positively to your message. And as Scott Galloway points out, as measured by adoption and usage, Facebook is the most successful thing in the history of mankind. There are 7.5 billion people in the world, and Facebook has a meaningful relationship with 2.2 billion of them. Its social network registers 50 minutes of a typical user's day. 1 in 6 minutes spent online is with Facebook. 1 in 5 minutes spent on mobile is with Facebook. When I talk about the power of SRM, I'm not blowing smoke. I'm simply citing the facts. Creating shareable stories, a case study. Because every business has to draw on its own history and products to develop a personal relationship with consumers, no one can offer a step-by-step rubric for you to follow. If you simply imitate a model, you're establishing an impersonal relationship. As Ben Horowitz says, I can't provide a recipe for challenges that have no recipe. There's no recipe for really complicated dynamic situations. That's the hard thing about hard things. There is no formula for dealing with them. That said, I can provide an example that will clarify the essential do's and don'ts of SRM relationships in a way you can adopt to your own particulars. A friend of mine works at SAS Institute, one of the largest privately held software companies in the world. Its primary focus and largest revenue stream is business analytics. A traditional marketing approach would be to offer testimonials from users or present side-by-side comparisons with the product of rival companies. Our graphs are better than their graphs. But we know that modern consumers reject blatant attempts to scream, "Buy me." Such stories begin and end with, and almost always, unsuccessful sales pitch. Think of it. A company offering infomercial-like details by computer geeks engaged with the spine-tingling process of analyzing data and telling you that, go figure, their product is better than the other products. Ugh, I'm getting sleepy just typing these sentences. Tim Staples drives home the futility of this approach by describing an SRM company in which J. Crew simply transmitted their old marketing content through a digital channel. They sent their Facebook followers a video of a vapid-looking young man who asserts that the company paying him to make the ad produces excellent t-shirts. They fit really well, and the cotton is especially soft. So, you know, you should buy one. The result? Exactly one of the 1.8 million recipients shared the video. And the one entry in the comments section consisted of a single word: rubbish. So now, consider the example set by the CEO at SAS. He learns about this fiasco and recognizes he's working in a wartime environment. So he decides to be a wartime CEO. He doesn't ask, "What's great about my products?" Instead of focusing on what he wants to sell, he decides to focus on the consumer, on telling a story and building a relationship by providing something of value. He reframes the question. If I forget about sales for a moment, what application of statistics, analytics, and artificial intelligence might people want to see on the internet? And he remembers that a division of his company has a project with a conservation group named WildTrak. And what do they do? They're trying to save a number of endangered species across the world: lions, cheetahs, and rhinos in Africa, tigers in India. Lions and tigers? Or graphs and advertising speak? It's not a hard choice. He tells his team to make a video focusing on big cats in Namibia, because who can resist a video about stalking lions and racing cheetahs? The video shows exotic African bushmen, experts in tracking these animals. We learn that every individual cat has a footprint as unique as our own fingerprints. The video mentions that statistics, analytics, and artificial intelligence can encode and refine information about those footprints so scientists can monitor population data and movement patterns, as well as the age, gender, and size of every individual. We see WildTrak scientists using software, but SAS stays wisely in the background, just enough so you might recall the name from the logo that appears without being mentioned in the final second of the video. The software is just a tool, a means to an end. It's a minor character with barely a walk-on part. Nobody is trying to sell anything. We're watching a video about wild animals, worrying about their survival, and admiring the people who are trying to save them. And it's riveting. It's the kind of video you start sharing with your friends even before you've finished watching. Through this approach, SAS, a North American company, took the first step in forming a genuine relationship with consumers around the world. People will eagerly watch the next installment of this story. And in every subsequent episode, SAS can begin to focus a bit more on its own contributions. It can introduce the tagline, "Using data for good." And since the company knows that budding researchers tend to stick with the analytic software they used in school and at the start of their careers, it's establishing lifelong consumers. By using SRM, the company can reach millions of potential buyers. You can't do that with a single commercial during a football or basketball game, and nobody is going to write rubbish in the comments section. In the next chapter, we'll look at why traditional marketing channels are drying up and what impact this will have on legacy brands. Can they survive? If so, what changes will they need to make? Is Scott Galloway correct when he says Google is the executioner of brands and media, or that death for brands has a name, Alexa, or is it Siri? In the impatience economy, is your new favorite brand whatever Google returns to you in 5 billionths of a second? I can guarantee you it is not.